to monitor its customer very carefully. By the 1990s, American mortgages were passing through at least 5 different institutions: originators, wholesalers of packages of mortgages, underwriters who assessed risk, government-sponsored enterprises, and servicers who managed the flow of interest income before being sold to an investor. Along that chain, what confidence could an investor have that the job was being done correctly? At each step of the way, the main concerns were volume and fees. Who had an interest in maintaining quality? Perhaps it was not the government subsidy, but these perverse incentives that led to the huge boom in bad lending and the crisis of 2007-2008. It is a theory that would have a superficial plausibility if the 1990s model of GSE-centered mortgage finance had still been dominant in the early 2000s. But, in fact, in the early 2000s, when the subprime boom unfolded, the industry had changed again. Securitization was more dominant than ever. The GSEs were still responsible for buying and securitizing the top-tier conforming mortgages, but as a new range of actors entered the mortgage market with a more dynamic and expansive agenda, their principal business model was not to disaggregate and to spread the risk, but to integrate every step of the process, including the holding of large quantities of securities on their own balance sheets. It was this growth model, based on integration, not disintegration, that would blow the system up. The path that led to the supercharged private mortgage industry of the early 2000s was twisted, but it too goes back to the breakdown of Bretton Woods in the 1970s and the unfettering of currencies, prices, interest rates, and capital movements that followed. It was not just the savings and loans, but the entire financial sector that was forced to rethink its business model. And this went for the investment banks of Wall Street as much as for the commercial banks. It is barely too much to say that the new, deregulated world of national and international finance was made for the investment banks. Through their business of trading on their clients' behalf and launching debt and other securities, they enjoyed an edge over all other participants in the market. In 1975, the abolition of fixed fees charged by Wall Street brokers for trading stocks led to fierce competition, wiped out smaller firms, and forced the integration of trading, research, and investment banking. In the 1980s, with interest rates coming down and bonds beginning their long bull run, trading in so-called fixed income securities, as opposed to equities, became ever more important. Drexel Burnham Lambert pioneered the market in high-yield corporate bonds, also known as junk bonds. Meanwhile, Salomon Brothers helped the GSEs devise the securitization model and launch each new batch of mortgage-backed securities. For other clients, the investment bankers were hard at work figuring out how to hedge against fluctuations in currencies and interest rates. They developed swaps, for instance, that allowed clients to trade excessive exposures in currencies. They made instruments that allowed one client to take on the risk of fluctuating interest rates, while another client opted for fixed rates. In the 1990s, a team at J.P. Morgan devised the Credit Default Swap, CDS, which offered protection against the risk of non-payment and allowed lenders to fine-tune their lending risk. At the same time, the investment banks progressively increased their own trading activity. They discovered the profits to be made through volume and leverage. The returns were extraordinary. In the early 1980s, America's investment banking elite earned returns of more than 50% on equity. But achieving scale raised the question of funding. Investment banks don't have deposits. They borrow the money they lend on wholesale markets from other banks or institutional funds. In the aftermath of the inflation and interest rate shocks of the late 1970s and early 1980s, this put them in a sweet spot. If investment banks didn't have depositors, that suited savers who, in the wake of the inflation, no longer wanted to put their money in bank deposits either. They opted instead for money market mutual funds, MMF. That characteristic financial institution of the new age. These were highly attractive to affluent households looking for better rates than those on offer from bank deposits. The money market mutual funds offered instantly accessible accounts without official government guarantee, but pledged by their private sector operators to return at least a dollar on the dollar, plus an attractive rate of interest on top. Bypassing the bankrupt savings and loans and the struggling commercial banks, cash deposits flowed into huge pools of professionally managed cash, looking for good yields on Wall Street. Nor were the MMFs the only ones. Corporations began to manage their cash pools more professionally. Ultra-rich individuals, who became more and more numerous from the 1970s onward, had billions of dollars that were managed by funds and family offices. By the end of the 1990s, perhaps as much as $1 trillion had accumulated in these institutional cash pools, looking for highly liquid, interest-yielding investment opportunities that were absolutely, or close to absolutely, safe. Lending against security, or buying the commercial paper of well-known investment banks, was precisely the kind of safe, short-term asset that the managers of the cash pools wanted. And acting as the banker to the fund's so-called prime brokerage was ideal business for the investment banks. These institutional cash pools and the liquidity they brought to wholesale funding markets were the rocket fuel for the rise of the modern investment bank. The more resources they mobilized, either by borrowing in the wholesale market or on deposit, the bigger the turnover, the larger the profits. Until the 1980s, investment banks were relatively small operations, partnerships, well-known and respected on Wall Street and the City of London, but not household names. The belief in the ability to manage risk inspired by the new derivative instruments, combined with access to the institutional cash pools, enabled them to scale up their size, creating the new Wall Street. Firms like Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and Merrill Lynch went from obscurity to star status. Originally built as partnerships, the huge scaling up of trading activity and the derivatives business meant that they needed to issue shares and go public. Merrill Lynch had done so already in 1971. Bear Stearns followed in 1985. Morgan Stanley in 1986. Goldman Sachs was the last to launch its IPO in May 1999. With Robert Rubin a classic exponent of this new Wall Street, the investment banks even had their man in government. Goldman Sachs began to earn its nickname as Government Sachs. Since the 1980s, the investment banks had built their businesses on navigating uncertainty. As asset markets boomed, they leveraged up. But sometimes uncertainty bites back. Between 1994 in Mexico and 1998 in Russia, the globalized American banks faced a series of major crises. In September 1998, but for concerted action by the major Wall Street firms, the implosion of long-term capital management triggered by the uncertainty spreading from Russia might have brought down the entire hedge fund industry. That was followed by the dot-com boom and bust in 1998 to 2001, a creation of the new Wall Street as much as of Silicon Valley. Finally, there was the spectacular accounting scandal at Enron, which took down once legendary accountants and management consultants Arthur Andersen. By the early 2000s, after two decades of dramatic growth, Wall Street was facing a political and regulatory backlash and urgently needed the next big thing. Given the expertise of the investment banks in bond trading and their role in the securitization of mortgages on behalf of the GSEs, it was not hard to foresee where scrappy investment banks like Lehman and Bear Stearns would look next. For the commercial banks, the post-Volcker age was tougher. They lost deposits. They lost mortgage business. Might they go the way of the savings and loans? To re-establish profitability in the 1990s, America's high street banks underwent spectacular consolidation. The top 10 banks increased their share of total assets from 10 to 50% between 1990 and 2000. In addition, they looked for a new business model. Rather than thinking of themselves as maintaining lifelong relationships with clients and their communities, they repurposed themselves as service providers for a fee. They had always originated mortgages, but had generally sold them to the GSEs. Given the pressure that they were now under, The mortgage market, with its multiple layers of origination, securitization, selling and servicing, seemed like a natural bridge between their familiar high street banking business and their aspirations to high finance. But to engage in that full range of activities, they needed regulatory relief. The New Deal-era regulations that separated retail from investment banking had to fall. The Clinton Treasury, first under Rubin and then under Larry Summers, gave them what they needed. In 1999, the last remnants of 1930s banking regulations were swept aside. Citigroup and Bank of America rushed through the opening to a new era of American universal banking. Stretching from the high street to Wall Street, it was a model more familiar from continental Europe, now applied to America. The third group of actors in the mortgage boom of the early 2000s was already in the business in the 1990s. They were banks like Washington Mutual, a survivor of the savings and loan disaster, and specialized mortgage lenders like Countrywide. As feeders to the GSEs, they were restricted to mortgage origination. But why limit their ambitions? Why not integrate the entire chain? By the late 1990s and early 2000s, all three groups of banks, investment banks, commercial banks, and mortgage lenders, were following this logic. Rather than organizing their mortgage business around the GSEs, they set out to build integrated mortgage securitization businesses. Countrywide expanded from origination to securitization. A giant bank like Citi could envision itself as a provider at every stage, originating, securitizing, selling, holding, and dealing in MBS. Even more remarkable was the evolution of investment banks like Lehman and Bear Stearns that had previously defined themselves through their remoteness from ordinary retail customers. Already in the 1990s, Bear added the mortgage originator and servicer EMC to its portfolio, and Lehman added four small mortgage lenders to its investment bank. By the early 2000s, the corporate strategies centered on private mortgage securitization were fully in place. But Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac still enjoyed a dominant position in the market thanks to their funding advantage. What gave the private mortgage securitization machine its chance was another interest rate shock combined with a hiccup at the GSE. When the dot-com bubble was followed by the shock of 9/11, the Fed dropped interest rates to 1%. As Alan Greenspan clearly intended, this unleashed a scramble among borrowers to refinance as many long-term mortgages as possible at lower rates. This was painful from the point of view of the original lenders, but it triggered an immediate wave of consumer spending, and for the mortgage industry it generated a huge surge in fees. The industry churned as it had never churned before. As compared with $1 trillion in new mortgages issued in 2001, in 2003, mortgage origination soared to $3.8 trillion, of which $2.53 trillion were for refinancing. In this huge boom, the GSEs were still the major players. They continued to monopolize the prime mortgage segment. Their share of the market reached its maximum point in 2003 at 57%. But at that point, it stalled. In the huge surge of business in the early 2000s, not everything at the GSEs was above board. Accounting and regulatory irregularities piled up. Fearful of another Enron, regulators subjected first Freddie Mac and then Fannie Mae to capital surcharges. They either had to raise new capital or contract their balance sheets. To make sure it was the latter, caps were imposed on their total balance sheet size. The door to the private issuers was opened. During Greenspan's refinancing boom of 2000 to 2003, it wasn't just the GSEs that were busy. The huge surge in issuance meant that there was plenty of unconventional, non-conforming business to go around too. But the decisive thing was what happened in early 2004, when interest rates had reached rock bottom, the refinancing boom had run its course, and the GSEs were stopped in their tracks. With the pipeline ready and waiting, it was at this point that the private mortgage industry took over. Leaving behind the GSE-centered model of the 1990s, they deprioritized conforming mortgages in favor of private label, unconventional lending. subprime, slightly better Alt-A, and oversized jumbo loans. What the private issuers discovered was that if scrutinizing conventional mortgages was profitable, subprime was even more so. The financial engineering was more elaborate and one could charge more money for the services. The techniques of the fixed income investment bankers were now brought fully into play. A surprisingly large share, even of non-conforming private label MBS, could still attract a AAA rating once combined in structured products. To manage the risks, the production of credit default swaps, CDS, once the preserve of bespoke investment banks, was industrialized. Mainline insurers like AIG offered CDS insurance on exotic securitized products. Given the quality of the underlying mortgages, not all the tranches were good. But that stimulated the investment banks to expand the collateralized debt obligation CDO business. CDOs were derivatives based on repackaged, middle-ranking, mezzanine tiers of other securitized mortgage deals. By combining them together and tranching, you could make a large pool of triple B assets yield further tranches of triple A securities. Once you had done that, you could then go one step further. You could take the low-rated mezzanine slices of the CDO and pool and tranche them once more to create CDO squared. And once again, by the logic of independent risks and the good graces of the ratings agencies, a portion even of those securities would warrant a AAA rating. By the early 2000s, the private mortgage industry was waiting for the starter's gun. It had its new raw material, securitized mortgages. It had its mechanics and its engineers at the ready. The end of the refinancing boom of 2003 in conventional mortgages triggered the push into unconventional lending. To unleash the final phase of the boom, it needed one last ingredient. Someone had to be interested in buying the hundreds of billions of dollars in securities that were being produced. If there had been no demand to meet the supply, the price of MBS would have fallen, yields would have surged, leading borrowing rates to rise, choking off the mortgage boom. Not only did this not happen, but long-term interest rates remained flat, and the spread, the premium that non-conforming borrowers had to pay, declined. This points to the third historic transformation that made possible the 2000s boom, a change not on the supply but on the demand side. The surging demand for safe assets and the mobilization of institutional cash pools for mortgage finance. It is at this point that the technical mechanics of mortgage banking reconnects with the grand theme of the rise of China, the emerging markets, and the mounting inequality and wealth polarization in the Western world. To understand this connection, the best place to start is to go back to the most scandalous thing about MBS. Their credit rating. The AAA label was important because it placed them in a class of assets like treasuries that attracted investors looking for safe assets. AAA was a badge of quality, and like any certificate of this type, it signaled that if what you were looking for was safety, you had to look no further. Such assets constitute as close as the unstable capitalist economy can offer to a neutral, safe position. They are desired, and in some cases legally required by all investors with a particular aversion to risk and little capacity for independent research or evaluation, pension funds, cash funds, insurance funds, and so on. As one of the key economists in the field has remarked, almost all human history can be written as the search for and the production of different forms of safe assets. This may be true. But it begs the question of what was happening in the late 1990s and early 2000s to drive a huge surge in the demand for safe assets. The first part of the answer is the development of the emerging market economies from the 1990s. As a result of their trade surpluses and their desire to self-insure against the risk of a repeat of the 1994 to 1998 crises, they wanted reserve assets that they could liquidate in an emergency. And the assets that best fit that description were U.S. treasuries, long and short-dated. In the early 2000s, China and other emerging market sovereigns bought all the treasuries that even the gaping budget deficits of the first Bush administration could provide. Macroeconomists worried about the current account imbalance that resulted and the possibility of a catastrophic sudden stop unwinding. What they did not pay attention to, because they did not dirty their hands with technicalities like MBS, was the effect the influx of emerging market funds might have in financial markets. Emerging market investors bought first treasuries, and then GSE-issued agency debt. This left other institutional investors looking for alternatives. What filled the gap was financial engineering. If pension funds, life insurers, and the managers of the gigantic cash pools accumulated by profitable corporations and the ultra-wealthy needed safe assets, AAA-rated securities were a product America's mortgage machine knew how to synthesize. But once again, we have to be careful. The shuffling of global demand for dollar-denominated safe assets helps to explain why the mortgage pipeline did not result in an oversupply of AAA securities. But to the extent that private-label asset-backed securities were actually sold off to investors, little more was heard of them. When the market turned bad, they would sit on balance sheets as an illiquid entry. They were no longer counted as safe assets. There would be lawsuits against investment banks that had knowingly repackaged unsafe mortgages. Certainly the losses would have an impact on investment allocation and on the spending decisions of millions of pensioners, but this would not, by itself, create a financial crisis, with bank failures rippling out across the world. The comparison with the dot-com bubble is instructive. It created a huge surge in wealth, followed by a collapse. It triggered a severe recession. But it did not lead to banking crises. The subprime mortgage boom of the early 2000s led to a financial crisis because, contrary to the professed logic of securitization, hundreds of billions of private-label MBS were not spread outside the banking system, but were stockpiled on the balance sheets of the mortgage originators and securitizers themselves. Why did the securitizers end up holding their own product? In part, it was a matter of the production system itself. Securitization produced some attractive tranches and some less so. The less attractive tranches needed to be held off the market. Furthermore, the banks operating the pipeline believed their own business proposition. Holding MBS was very profitable at prevailing funding costs. The banks in the mortgage supply chain were at the source of the profit, so why not get rich too? It was a choice. Not every bank did it. Those that took the biggest risks were large mortgage originators and the most aggressively expansive commercial banks, Citigroup, Bank of America, and Washington Mutual, and the two smallest and scrappiest investment banks, Lehman and Bear Stearns. By contrast, J.P. Morgan began throttling back its mortgage pipeline already in 2006 and bought as much protection as it could in the CDS market. Goldman Sachs went beyond hedging to place a large bet on an imminent housing market collapse. Their caution was easy to justify given the kind of business that subprime lending involved, but it also reflected a more basic banking consideration. Building a big balance sheet of MBS didn't just involve risk on the asset side. It also involved expanding the liabilities of the bank on the funding side. And this brings us to the true heart of the 2007 to 2008 crisis. If the mortgage production line was holding hundreds of billions of private label MBS and ABS on its own balance sheet, how were those holdings funded? Here, too, it was the new model of investment banking that provided the answer. If an upstart mortgage lender like Countrywide didn't have depositors, neither did Lehman. Lehman got its funding wholesale by tapping the cash pools. And so too would the new mortgage lenders, including Lehman. This was the truly lethal mechanism at the heart of the crisis. Funds from money market cash pools were channeled into financing the holding of large balance sheets of MBS. The largest mechanism for funding mortgage holdings was asset-backed commercial paper, ABCP. The three biggest American issuers of ABCP were Bank of America, Citigroup, and J.P. Morgan. The vehicles for managing this operation were so-called Structured Investment Vehicles, SIV, legal entities provided with a minimum layer of capital by their sponsors, but otherwise separate from the balance sheets of their parent banks. Onto these SIVs, the parent bank would offload a large portfolio of mortgage bonds, securitized car loans, credit card debt, or student debt. The SIV would pay the parent bank for the securities with funds raised by issuing ABCP. These were 3-month notes backed by the assets in the SIV and the good name of the parent bank. Though the SIV had no track record, it could issue the commercial paper at competitive rates because of the value of the securities it held and because it was assumed that it enjoyed the backing of the sponsoring bank. Remarkably, under the bank regulations prevailing until the early 2000s, assets parked off-balance sheet in the SIV could be backed by a fraction of the capital that would be required if they were on-balance sheet. Inflating the balance sheet was risky, but it raised rates of return on capital. Further profits were to be made by trading on the spread between long-term returns and short-term funding costs. Typically, an ABCP vehicle would hold a portfolio of securities with maturities of 3 to 5 years and would fund those securities by selling commercial paper repayable between 3 months and as little as a few days. For the managers of cash pools, the commercial paper was more attractive than the underlying securities because it was very short-term and backed by a top-rated commercial bank. For the parent banks, the spread between the return from the high-risk cocktail of assets held in the SIV and the low rate paid on the highly rated ABCP was handsome. If the SIV-ABCP model involved a degree of maturity mismatch, the investment banks pushed this to extremes. The entire business model of investment banks was based on wholesale funding. The most elastic vehicles for this were so-called repurchase agreements, or repo. In a repo transaction, a bank would buy a security and pay for the purchase by immediately reselling it for a period of as little as 1 night or as long as 3 months, with a promise to repurchase at a certain price. It was, in effect, a collateralized short-term funding agreement. The investment bank would buy $100 million in securities and repo them with a mutual fund or another investment bank, with the party repoing the paper paying a small interest charge to the investor it was repoing with. It also accepted a haircut. In exchange for $100 million in treasuries, it did not receive full value, but only $98 million in cash. It would also repurchase them for $98 million. In the meantime, the haircut determined how much of its own money the investment bank would have to put into holding the securities, and thus the leverage in the deal. A 2% haircut meant that to fund the purchase of $100 million of securities and to receive the interest paid on those bonds, a bank would need $2 million of its own money. The rest it could get out of the repo transaction. Using this mechanism, a small amount of capital could support a far bigger balance sheet, provided, of course, that the repo could be repeatedly rolled and that the haircut did not suddenly increase. By the 2000s, the collateral posted in repo markets in New York ran to several trillions of dollars a day. It was split into two markets, bilateral and tri-party repo. Both were over-the-counter professional markets, which were only loosely monitored by the central banks or regulators. The best data we have is for trilateral repo, where the trade was managed by a third party, either J.P. Morgan Chase or Bank of New York Mellon, which held the collateral for the duration of the repo. In tri-party repo, the collateral used was of top quality, almost exclusively treasuries or agency MBS. Given the additional layer of protection, tri-party repo was where institutional cash pools like MMFs did their repo. Tri-party was not used to fund private label MBS. It was in the bilateral repo market that they could be funded. The best available data suggests that the bilateral repo market was 3 times larger than the tri-party segment. Because the players in the bilateral market tended to be investment banks and hedge funds, the types of assets acceptable as collateral were more wide-ranging. It is here, along with ABCP and various types of interbank and unsecured borrowing, that the investment banks financed their holding of private label MBS and CDO portfolios. Given the wide range of collateral, haircuts in the bilateral repo market ranged in the spring of 2007 from 0.25% on U.S. Treasuries to 10% or more for asset-backed loans of inferior quality. As in commercial paper, repo was exposed to serious funding risk. You might not be rolled over. Specifically, the risk was that if an investment bank like Lehman or Bear was thought to have suffered major losses on some big part of its portfolio, whether that was funded by commercial paper, bilateral repo, or other types of interbank borrowing, it would suffer a general loss of confidence. It would then be considered ineligible as a counterparty in the tri-party market and would find itself shut out from critical funding. The scale of the potential risk was huge. At Lehman, at the end of fiscal year 2007, of its balance sheet of $691 billion, 50% was funded through repo. At Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, and Morgan Stanley, the share was 40%. If any of these investment banks was to lose access to the repo markets, at a stroke its business model would collapse, taking its entire balance sheet, not just its MBS business, but its derivatives book, currency and interest swaps, down with it. With so many interests engaged, the expansion in U.S. mortgage lending in the final burst of the boom was spectacular, not to say grotesque. Between 1999 and 2003, 70% of the new mortgages issued in the United States were still conventional, GSE-conforming. With the end of the refinancing boom, that balance shifted. By 2006, 70% of new mortgages were subprime or other unconventional loans destined for securitization not by the GSE, but as private label MBS. In both 2005 and 2006, $1 trillion in unconventional mortgages were issued, compared with $100 billion in 2001. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were scrambling to keep up, purchasing $300 billion in non-agency securitized mortgages to hold in their own portfolios. The GSEs were driven. They were not the drivers. They were competing with upstarts like Countrywide, which in 2006 was responsible for originating 20% of all mortgages in the United States. They were competing with an ultra-sophisticated investment bank like Lehman Brothers that had assembled an entire pipeline. In 2005, 2/3 of the mortgages contained in Lehman's issuance of $133 billion in MBS CDO were sourced from its own subprime loan originators. A top Wall Street name was scraping the very bottom of the credit barrel. The message that this communicated down the food chain was simple. We want more mortgage debt to process, and the worse the quality, the better. By the magic of independent probabilities, the worse the quality of the debt that entered into the tranching and pooling process, the more dramatic the effect. Substantial portions of undocumented, low-rated, high-yield debt emerged as AAA. In any boom, irresponsible, near-criminal, or outright fraudulent behavior is to be expected. But the mortgage securitization mechanism systematically produced this race to the bottom in mortgage lending quality. It was the difference between the high yield of the underlying securities included in the collateral pool and the low interest that was paid to the investors who bought the AAA-rated asset-backed securities that generated the profit. From 2004, fully half the subprime mortgages being fed into the system had incomplete or zero documentation, and 30% were interest-only loans to people who had no prospect of making basic repayment. The ratings agencies would subsequently face penetrating questions about their complicity in this process. It did not help that they were paid by the banks for which they rated the bonds, and that the big three ratings agencies competed with one another to offer the most streamlined and cheap route to AAA ratings. In their defense, they would argue that they were operating tried and tested formulae that had the stamp of approval of the smartest economists in the land. But payment was by results. Fitch, which applied a risk assessment model that generated fewer of the coveted AAA-rated securities, found itself largely cut out of the subprime securitization business. As later congressional inquiries revealed, the ratings agency staff at Moody's and S&P were clearly aware of the monster they were creating. As one ratings expert remarked to another in an email in December 2006, "Let's hope we're all wealthy and retired by the time this house of cards falters." Certainly some people were getting wealthy. The profits of the 1980s and late 1990s had been good in investment banking. Now everyone was making money. In the early 2000s, 35% of all profits in the US economy were earned by the financial sector. At the very top, it was dizzying. Though in the course of the 1990s they had converted to public companies, selling shares to investors, the Wall Street firms continued to operate effectively as partnerships. The rule was that half of net revenue after interest costs was reserved for staff payments, the other half being paid to shareholders. The 2006 business year generated $60 billion in bonuses for the finance crowd in New York, and 2007 topped that with $66 billion in bonuses. For senior staff at the investment banks, that translated into payments in the tens of millions of dollars each. Richard Fold, who drove Lehman's dramatic growth as CEO from 1994, earned $484.8 million in salary and bonus between 2000 and 2008. That was staggering enough. But to understand the psychology of those operating the system, one has to appreciate that even the top investment bankers knew that they were not the real kings of the money game. Their remuneration paled by comparison with that of the hedge fund managers with whom they dealt in the prime brokerage, repo, and ABCP markets. At the hedge funds and private equity groups, individuals could earn hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars per annum. In 2007, the six top hedge fund managers earned at least $1 billion each in compensation. Nor was the greed confined to the top. No doubt many mortgage borrowers were victimized by a process that systematically misled them and had every interest to do so. But once a real estate market shifts from a state of equilibrium to one of boom, everyone becomes a speculator willy-nilly. As capital appreciation came to be expected, the meaning of home ownership changed. Homeowners, whether they liked it or not, were taking a speculative position. At the bottom, those who got on the housing ladder by taking out adjustable-rate, low-credit-score mortgages were speculating that their properties would rise in value so much that their equity would be sufficient to refinance on better terms. Those further up the ladder engaged in a fiesta of real estate speculation. In 2006, fully a third of new mortgages issued in the United States were for second, third, or even fourth properties. In what became known as the bubble states, Florida, Arizona, California, the percentage was as high as 45%. Obviously, these were not the fortunes being made on Wall Street or on the Gold Coast of Connecticut, but real estate speculation had become a mass sport. All told, if we focus on that section of the market that was truly a product of the bubble, by the summer of 2007, $5.213 trillion in private-label asset-backed securities had been issued. That is, MBS generated from unconventional mortgages and credit card, student loan, and auto debt. Of this total, the most dangerous mortgage component, subprime mortgage MBS, amounted to $1.3 trillion. Though this was only 12% of the total American mortgage market, the $1.3 trillion had been produced in a single surge since 2003. Of the total sum of $5.13 trillion, more than $3 trillion had been placed with long-term investors, and $700 billion were placed directly with investment funds or investment banks. But $1.173 trillion were held by banks that funded them off-balance sheet by issuing ABCP. As a result, ABCP had become the largest short-term money market instrument for investors looking to park cash for less than 3 months. The market for ABCP was larger even than for the short-term treasury bills issued by the US government to manage its cash flow. If there was a channel through which the crisis in real estate could ramify outward to unleash the global financial crisis, this was it. ABCP, the place where private label MBS met wholesale funding. Every year in August, the elite of the central banking and monetary economics world gathers at a resort in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. In August 2005, the theme of the conference was not the crisis brewing in the U.S. housing market, but a celebration in honor of the outgoing Fed chairman, Alan Greenspan. Most of the presentations were appropriately upbeat, but one rang an off note. It was given by Raghuram G. Rajan, an Indian by birth but a fully paid-up member of the American economics elite, professor at the Chicago Booth Business School and chief economist at the IMF. His paper bore the heretical title, "Has Financial Development Made the World Riskier?" Rajan worried that the dramatic expansion of modern financial intermediation was building up a dangerous new appetite for risk. At Greenspan's farewell party, the message was not welcome. Rajan was slapped down by Larry Summers. Wielding his full authority as former Treasury Secretary, Summers introduced himself as someone who has learned a great deal about this subject from Alan Greenspan and who finds the basic, slightly Luddite premise of this paper to be largely misguided. To highlight risks in a complex modern financial system, as Rajan was tactlessly doing, was to invite restriction and other misguided policy impulses. It would be like giving up air travel for fear of crashes. This response from Summers, his warning that even to discuss risks within the system was to incite dangerous political reactions and tantamount to resisting technological progress, was emblematic of the attitudes that had driven a 40-year deregulatory push. The truly decisive early moves went back to the re-emergence of a global capital market in the 1960s, the collapse of Bretton Woods, the deregulation of interest rates and capital flows in the early 1980s. It was those moves that unleashed monetary instability and precipitated Volcker's interest rate shock. It was that turmoil which forced innovation in the housing market and gave rise to the hyperactive new breed of Wall Street investment banks. The competitive flows of capital thus unleashed drove all that followed. Rubin and Summers added a personal touch with the 1999 Financial Services Modernization Act, which released the final restraints on the fusion of commercial and investment banking. Within months of departing the Treasury, Rubin had returned to banking at Citigroup. Summers took slightly longer to join Wall Street, but barely a year after the clash with Rajan at Jackson Hole, he had joined hedge fund D.E. Shaw as a part-time managing director. Summers's reaction to Rajan is all the more telling because the signs of stress in the world economy were so obvious. At the level of macroeconomic policy, Summers himself was willing to sound the alarm with his talk of a balance of financial terror. The commonplace recommendation to tighten fiscal policy might have helped, but this pointed the finger away from where the stress really was, in the financial system. Indeed, from the point of view of financial stability, it might have been desirable if more of the AAA securities in circulation had been genuine U.S. government debt, rather than the products of financial engineering. In the final analysis, it was convenient to make the case at the level of macroeconomic aggregates. It was particularly easy to demand that a Republican president change his course. It was far less comfortable to question the house price boom and the giant Wall Street edifice erected on top of it. The boosters far outnumbered the Cassandras, and not just at Jackson Hole. The mortgage industry lobby did its job. David Luray, the chief economist for the National Association of Realtors, chipped in with a book titled Why the Real Estate Boom Will Not Bust. Conservative pundits such as Larry Kudlow, economics editor of the National Review, railed against All the bubbleheads who expect housing price crashes in Las Vegas or Naples, Florida, to bring down the consumer, the rest of the economy, and the entire stock market. Kudlow need not have worried. There was little sense of any urgency on the part of the authorities about limiting the boom. Briefly, following Enron, there was a push for greater regulation. There was talk about requiring the parent sponsors of the off-balance sheet SIVs to put more capital behind them. The threat alone was enough to bring growth in the ABCP industry to a halt. Moody's warned investors that banks might soon face the end of one of their easiest funding sources. But in July 2004, as subprime was really hitting its stride, the regulators agreed to provide a permanent exemption that effectively allowed assets held in SIVs to be backed by only 10% of the capital that would have been required if the assets were held on the balance sheets of the banks themselves. This was particularly attractive for big commercial banks like Citigroup and Bank of America that were subject to relatively tight capital regulation, putting them at a huge disadvantage to the lightly regulated investment banks. It was following that regulatory shift that the ABCP market exploded from $650 billion to in excess of $1 trillion. By the summer of 2007, Citigroup alone was guaranteeing $92.7 billion in ABCP, enough to wipe out its entire Tier 1 capital. More than the grand gestures of deregulation, like the 1999 Act, it was this kind of apparently small-scale regulatory change that unfettered the growth of shadow banking. The same was true for repo. Traditionally, repo had been limited by the fact that the categories of assets that were exempt from the automatic stay in case of bankruptcy included only U.S. government and agency securities, bank certificates of deposits, and bankers' acceptances. If those classes of security were offered as collateral in repo, in cases of bankruptcy they could be seized without delay, and any losses made good. In 2005, the Bankruptcy Abuse Prevention and Consumer Protection Act gave creditors much stronger protection against defaulting borrowers, which, ironically, increased their willingness to lend. But it also expanded the repo collateral provided with special protection to include mortgage loans and mortgage-related securities. Not surprisingly, in the wake of the Act, there was a surge in bilateral repo secured on non-standard assets. Could the Fed have contained the bubble through tougher interest rate policy? Greenspan's cuts of the early 2000s had triggered the lending surge. Indeed, it had clearly been Greenspan's intention to unleash a refinancing boom to help the recovery from the dot-com bust and the shock of 9/11. But what the Fed did not appreciate was the structural change in the mortgage machine the refinancing boom would trigger. Certainly by 2004, it was clear that it was time to raise rates. In 17 tiny steps, the Fed inched rates from 1% in June 2004 to 5.25% in June 2006. It was fine-tuning, not shock and awe. The mortgage boom continued undeterred, as did global demand for American safe assets and the expansion of the shadow banking sector. By the spring of 2006, to the alarm of many commentators, the result was that the yield curve was inverted. Long-term rates were below the short-term interest rates set by the Fed. This was usually a signal for trouble. It meant that the normal bank funding model of borrowing short to lend long no longer made any sense. In due course, the inversion of the yield curve might by itself have produced a recession, but it wasn't Greenspan or Bernanke who killed the mortgage boom. It killed itself. By 2005, at the latest, it was clear that low-quality mortgage debt was a ticking bomb. Many of the subprime mortgages were on balloon rates that would rapidly increase after a period of 2 or 3 years. In 2007, the typical adjustable-rate mortgage in the United States, favored by low-income borrowers, was resetting from an annual rate of 7-8% to 10-10.5%. As traders such as Greg Lipman at Deutsche Bank realized, between August 2006 and August 2009, $738 billion in mortgages would experience payment shock. As the escalated interest payments hit, a wave of defaults was more or less inevitable. Once that began, it was only a matter of time before house prices stopped increasing and the market turned. At that point, millions of speculative real estate investments would go bad. Families would lose their homes. Thousands of MBS would suffer default, and whoever held insurance would get rich. Nowhere in Lippmann's extensive document arguing for Deutsche Bank to short MBS was there any mention of Fed tightening. The subprime mortgage machine had a self-tightening timer built in. Unless house prices continued to rise at record rates, it would activate mercilessly and stop the boom in its tracks. It was the first round of that tightening that was beginning to make itself felt in the most stressed communities across the United States already in 2006. Default rates were rising. It would not be long before the AAA rating granted to the lowest quality CDO would be in doubt. To take advantage, a growing band of contrarian investors began to build the big short positions that would make them famous. Those making the play included Lippmann at Deutsche Bank, J.P. Morgan, and Goldman Sachs, as well as a cluster of hedge funds. To build the position, they bought CDS, derivatives designed to provide protection against default. Anticipating shipwreck, the holders of the big short were making advanced bookings in the lifeboat. They could either hold their insurance until the bonds failed and their payouts were due, or they could sell their positions at a huge profit to lenders who were desperate for default protection. The question was one of timing, and the problem was funding. Going long in CDS when majority opinion was still driving the market up was an expensive and nerve-wracking proposition. You were on the other side of the last surge in ABCP and repo deals. At Citigroup, in the summer of 2007, CEO Chuck Prince was still telling journalists that, as long as the music is playing, you've got to get up and dance. We're still dancing. The question was what would happen when the music stopped. Chapter 3. Transatlantic Finance. Americans liked to think of their problems as American, and outsiders were only too happy to concur. As the mortgage meltdown spread like a lethal virus across urban America in 2007 to 2008, European commentators took up the narrative of an American national crisis. Feral financial capitalism, like the Iraq war and climate change denial, was part of a toxic Anglo-American variant on modernity. When the storm broke in 2008, the schadenfreude among European politicians was palpable. The polite phrases at the UN only scratched the surface. On September 16, 2008, as Wall Street unraveled, Peer Steinbrück, Germany's tough-talking SPD finance minister, went before the Bundestag to announce that the global financial system faced a crisis originating in America from which Germany had so far been spared. America's laissez-faire ideology, as practiced during the subprime crisis, was as simplistic as it was dangerous, he later told Germany's parliamentarians. He confidently expected that America would soon forfeit its role as financial superpower. French President Sarkozy chirped along with him. Just returned from New York on September 25th, Sarkozy, who had formerly been regarded as a true disciple of Atlantic capitalism, told a crowd in Toulon that the idea that the markets were always right was mad. Laissez-faire is finished. The all-powerful market that always knows best is finished. And just in case anyone wondered where the home of that mad idea was, Giulio Tremonti, Silvio Berlusconi's outspoken finance minister, boasted that Italy's banking system would be fine because it did not speak English. It was convenient, but it was a self-deception. America's securitized mortgage system had been designed from the outset to suck foreign capital into U.S. financial markets, and foreign banks had not been slow to see the opportunity. Since the 1980s, Americans had grown used to the idea that Asians, first the Japanese, now the Chinese, owned their government debt. That was the anxiety that haunted the Hamilton Project. What they did not reckon with was that foreigners owned a large portion of America's houses. By 2008, roughly a quarter of all securitized mortgages were held by foreign investors. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac funded $1.7 trillion of their portfolio of $5.4 trillion in mortgage-backed securities by selling securities to foreigners. China was by far the biggest foreign investor in these agency bonds, with holdings estimated at $500 to $600 billion. But in the riskier segment of the securitized mortgage business, it was Europeans, not Asians, who led the way. For non-conforming high-risk MBS, those not backed by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, the share held by European investors was in the order of 29%. In 2006, at the height of the US mortgage securitization boom, a third of newly issued private label MBS were backed by British or European banks. The segment of the securitization chain in which European banks were of truly crucial importance was also the weakest link in the chain, ABCP. In the summer of 2007, though it was Citigroup that had the largest off-balance sheet SIV exposure, it was European banks that dominated the market. Overall, two-thirds of the commercial paper issued had European sponsors, including 57% of the dollar-denominated commercial paper. Europe's banks had good standing with the ratings agencies, but they did not have large dollar-denominated depositor bases. If they wanted to get in on the MBS boom, they needed to go to the wholesale market. Among the European sponsors, German financial institutions were particularly prominent, and what was remarkable was the kind of German bank that was involved. Germany's giant, Deutsche Bank, was a leading player on Wall Street. It is not for nothing that it featured as prominently as it did in Michael Lewis's best-selling narrative of the crisis, The Big Short, or in the subsequent Senate investigation. Dresdner Bank, Germany's number two, was also heavily involved in the United States. But it was Germany's smaller, regional banks, the Landesbanken, that threw themselves head over heels into the American adventure. In the early 2000s, at the insistence of Brussels, the Landesbanken were stripped of the local state guarantees that lowered their funding costs. They responded by taking a punt on adventurous financial engineering. Banks from the former industrial heartland of Germany, such as Saxon Finanzgruppe, WestLB and IKB of Düsseldorf, took huge gambles on real estate investments in the United States. At least four German sponsors, Saxon, WestLB, IKB, and Dresdner, had ABCP exposure large enough to wipe out their equity capital several times over. Nor did European banks confine themselves to dealing in the securities. The Europeans went native, joining their American counterparts in integrating down the supply chain so as to control mortgage origination itself. After all, if a Wall Street investment bank could do it, why not a European bank with some experience in retail banking? From the mid-1990s, banks like Britain's HSBC aggressively bought into the American mortgage market. By 2005, HSBC could boast of having serviced 450,000 mortgages to a total value of $70 billion. Credit Suisse built an American mortgage servicing department that fed one of the largest ABS CDO operations of the early 2000s. Deutsche Bank had close relationships with the giant mortgage-generating machines at Countrywide and Ameriquest. In 2006, the German bank bought the subprime specialists Mortgage IT Holdings and Chapel Funding LLC. As a Deutsche Bank press release glowed, ownership of these operations at the bottom of the U.S. credit pyramid would provide significant competitive advantages, such as access to a steady source of product for distribution into the mortgage capital markets. From the point of view of generating high-yielding CDOs, it was precisely the bottom of the mortgage barrel that was most attractive. How was this possible? It was easy enough to understand how China acquired claims on the United States. It had a gigantic trade surplus, the dollar proceeds of which were bought up by its financial authorities and invested in U.S. treasuries, giving rise to Larry Summers's scenario of a balance of financial terror. But among those who worried about global macroeconomic imbalances, Europe was rarely mentioned. The EU current account surplus with the United States was modest compared with that of China. With the world as a whole, Europe's current account was in modest deficit. The Europeans did not peg their currencies against the dollar. There was no agency in Brussels accumulating foreign assets as part of a currency stabilization effort, no German sovereign wealth funds. So how did European banks end up owning such a large slice of American mortgage debt? The answer is that European banks operated just like their adventurous American counterparts. They borrowed dollars to lend dollars. And the scale of this activity is revealed if we look not at the net flow of capital in and out of the United States, inflows minus outflows, which has its counterpart in the trade deficit or surplus, but at the gross flows, which record how many assets were bought and sold in each direction. As the gross inflow data show, by far the largest purchasers of U.S. assets, by far the largest foreign lenders to the United States prior to the crisis, were not Asian, but European. Indeed, in 2007, roughly twice as much money flowed from the UK to the United States as from China. Before 2008, the net financial flow from Asia to the United States could reasonably be construed as the financial counterpart to America's trade deficit with Asia. By contrast, the financial flows between Europe and the United States made up a financial circulatory system quite independent of the trade connections between the two. Across the Pacific, from Asia to the United States, money flowed one way. In the North Atlantic financial system, it flowed both ways, both in and out of the United States. This was in the logic of the market-based banking model. Europe's banks did not have branches spread across the United States, but a Wall Street firm like Lehman didn't either. This was the beauty of the market-based model of banking. You borrowed the dollars on Wall Street to fund your holdings of mortgages from all over the United States. The ABCP market was a showcase for this transatlantic system. The ABCP conduits organized bundles of securitized assets from the United States and Europe. With those securities as collateral, they then issued short-term commercial paper, which was bought by the managers of cash pools in the United States. In 2008, $1 trillion, or half, of the prime non-government money market funds in the United States were invested in the debt and commercial paper of European banks and their vehicles. A large portion of this simply moved from one office on Wall Street to another, with one address being adorned with the name of a European bank. But hundreds of billions of dollars took a more circuitous route. They flowed out of the United States from the branches of foreign banks in New York to the head offices of European banks, from which they returned for investment in the United States, sometimes by way of an offshore tax haven such as Dublin or the Cayman Islands. It was the spinning motion of this transatlantic financial axis that impelled the surge in financial globalization in the early 21st century. In managing these flows, the multi-currency balance sheets of European banks played a crucial role. To understand the nature of these flows, take the example of a German bank keen to participate in the lucrative American mortgage business. The bank did not have an existing depositor base in dollars. Its existing liabilities, deposits, bonds issued, and short-term borrowing, were in euros. This meant that the German bank had a funding problem if it wanted to lend in dollars. But in that respect, it was no different from a Wall Street investment bank.